To keep the fodder to a minimum, we rarely let the pool film or photograph the president while he was on the course. Instead, we staged the pool vans about a block away. One summer afternoon, we lined up on the wrong block and missed the motorcade. That meant they couldn't report in real time exactly when the president left and when he returned. They wondered if something was up, worried that they were missing important news. They weren't. It was a routine drive home. Still, the pool let me have it in the van, yelling, bickering, complaining all the way back to the White House. I was pissed at them, but I also knew they were right. Where's the president now? That's what the print reporter in charge of writing pool reports called out every few minutes, both to do her job and to get back at me. It was like a backseat driver asking, "Are we there yet?" Where's the president? It was the same thing Josh was anxious about as he scampered to Upper Press on a similarly beautiful day the following summer. "Pat, I need a favor." I had recently moved on from wrangling to writing. For me, golf trips were a thing of the past, and I was toiling away at my desk on the White House daily message points, which I sent every day to stakeholders, from basketball legend Charles Barkley and POTUS's high school friends to liberal economists and political pundits, anybody who we thought might spread the good word about the news of the day. But this day was getting out of hand, and this was an all-hands-on-deck moment. Josh told me, "We don't know where the president is right now." It was the summer of 2014, and the president was feeling a bit caged in. He wanted out of the bubble. We had developed a term for it earlier in the summer, when POTUS veered from the pre-approved path around the White House to greet tourists nearby. "The bear is loose," we took to saying. In fact, that's exactly what the president told Jennifer Palmieri as he departed the White House with Dennis. They were going to Dunkin' Donuts, we thought. The Wranglers scrambled to assemble a pool and made a run for it toward Dunkin' Donuts. Half of the pool got left behind and was waiting out front of the West Wing lobby as I burst through the doors. The Marine who typically guarded the door, opening it for everyone who walks through, was off duty, which meant the president truly wasn't in the West Wing. Without stopping, I waved the pool to follow, as we darted through the Northwest Gate and headed north toward Dunkin'. Just as we were about to cross into Lafayette Park, I spotted a commotion to our left, up Pennsylvania Avenue. It had to be him. He was at Starbucks. I did my best to keep the pool at bay, but it was pandemonium when we arrived. The pool crept close. "Come on, guys, give me some space," the president asked, coffee cup in hand. Somebody asked what he ordered. It had to be tea. That's all he drank during the day. Rather than answer, he looked at me. "Let's test your wrangling skills." At that point, I started screaming at the pool, back up, let's go, pool," and every wrangler's favorite euphemism for "leave this instant." "Thank you, pool." The case of the missing president was solved quickly, but the ramifications lasted quite a bit longer. The Secret Service wasn't thrilled, and the press corps was up in arms. Unacceptable, they thought. The poor guy just wanted to take a walk, but it was a reminder that he couldn't. Yeah, Barack Obama could theoretically go for a stroll whenever he wanted, but the president can't. Thank you, pool. These flare-ups often come off as petty press problems, and we were frequently frustrated by their fretting. But the White House Correspondents Association, the group that represents the press and advocates for coverage of the administration, was right to push for more access. It was their duty to obsess over the pool's continued coverage. There's no law mandating that the president be covered continuously by a press pool. It's simply a White House norm, preserved by tradition. Like so many norms, it can be upended. That's why it needs to be protected every day, by the press, by the president, and by the people of the United States demanding to know what's going on, taking agency over their citizenship. There's a reason it's called the People's House. It's clear that the White House press pool plays a crucial role in our democracy, and if common sense prevails, it's not going away anytime soon. But with an evolving media landscape, tight budgets, and shifting norms, change will come to the pool over time. Fewer individuals per pool, possibly. New, less traditional companies, BuzzFeed, and who knows what else next, joining the ranks of the rotating outlets, for instance. The form it ultimately takes and when the pool evolves are less important than the basic function of the press pool continuing. That's a norm that should be an ironclad rule. There is another White House custom that appears to be in limbo, its future considered by some to be on the chopping block. The daily press briefing, even with its live feeds and miles of wires where the famous White House swimming pool used to be, can feel archaic. hearkening back to a time when what was learned at the briefing drove the day, when the press secretary could steer the day's narrative from behind his or her podium. That capability, for a number of reasons, some good, some not so much, has been diminished. Still, Josh recently put it to me this way. The daily briefing gives the White House an unrivaled platform to advocate and defend the president's agenda. It also gives journalists, as agents of the American people, the opportunity to ask skeptical, pressing questions to hold those in power accountable for their actions and demand transparency into how that power is being used. At its best, that's exactly what it does. Picture the first row in the White House briefing room. What do you see? Probably reporters jostling for attention, jotting notes, holding the president to account. And it's true. The first row is filled with reporters at their professional peak, many fulfilling a lifelong dream, years of diligent work in the making, grilling the administration, rooting out answers, sifting through half-truths and misspeaks, exposing evasions. So what's the problem? Well, the Brady Press briefing room has more than one row. The room has moved away from the gritty, wizened reporter, the Helen Thomas, a legend who questioned 10 presidents from the front row, toward younger journalists looking to bigger and better things. Somewhere along the way, for many, the White House beat became a stepping stone. Too often, the reporters are out for themselves or their network, which is understandable, just not ideal for getting at answers, insight, and the truth. The regular White House TV reporters with whom I dealt when I first started as a Wrangler were, for the most part, a gifted, driven bunch. Some of them would hit it big in just a few years. Chuck Todd became host of the vaunted Meet the Press, which my dad sits down to watch every Sunday and considers a religious experience. Jake Tapper was the breakout star of the 2016 election cycle. Savannah Guthrie went on to Today Show fame, and Nora O'Donnell became co-host of CBS This Morning and a contributor to 60 Minutes. Chuck, I remember, would pressure Jay and Josh about the press digs. Mainly, he thought that the press should be allowed to dine at Ike's on the first floor of the EEOB, an unassuming office cafeteria named for President Eisenhower. It would be much easier than the press having to leave campus and go through security all over again, just to grab lunch. We never had a great retort. Our denial didn't make a ton of sense. Maybe it would have been the right thing to do. Chuck and Jake, Savannah and Nora aside, many TV reporters were and are rewarded for asking the same question that their peer has just asked, solely so there's footage of them asking it for their respective nightly news or cable outlet. It does nothing to further the debate or probe deeper for answers. It can become an echo chamber. The questions can become the story. As one lower press staffer once put it bluntly to one of our favorite reporters, you are self-fulfilling, vacuous whores. One TV reporter, a well-meaning, talented woman named Mandy, always needed just 2 seconds. 2 seconds from Jay, or 2 seconds from Josh, 2 seconds from anybody. Didn't matter what the topic was. Syria, the Affordable Care Act, gun violence, 2 seconds was all it would take, which was all the time cable news allowed for substance or policy reporting anyway. So it worked out. In many ways, Mandy was cable news come to life. Breathless and quick, she was a walking headline ticker. When something was breaking in the news, she was often the first to breeze through our walkway into upper press, assuming, of course, that nobody had 2 seconds to spare in lower press. She was usually followed closely behind by other members of the proven traditional organizations that claimed seats in the first few rows of the press briefing room. The Associated Press, the Times, the Post, the Journal, the Chicago Tribune, and NBC News, for instance. One evening, as the president was said to be pondering a military strike across the world, and we were waiting on word from our friends in the National Security Council for an update, my bosses were standing around in upper press discussing the state of play. How would we roll out the decision to the press one way or the other? Who would we give the story to first? Should we do a background briefing? What were the talking points? All good questions, but it was getting late, and I hadn't had a Mountain Dew in hours. I noticed the time. I had only 1 minute before it would be too late. The White House Navy Mess is a one-window pickup spot, run by the U.S. Navy, that offers breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and of course, its famous chicken fingers and waffle fries. Staffers dialed from their desks. It was the only number nobody ever forgot, and placed orders. It was also where you could pick up snacks and coffee as well as soda, which was the only product we were allowed free of charge. I took full advantage, doing the do like it was part of my job. But on this evening, I knew any second the man behind the counter would erect the wooden plank, concealing the mess's pickup window like it was never there. Closing time. As I dashed down the hall to the steps to the West Wing basement toward the mess, I stopped dead in my tracks. Hello, Johnny. There he was, a well-respected reporter from one of the aforementioned front-row outlets. He was loitering, slinking slowly back and forth by the top of the steps down to the basement. He had been listening in on my bosses from just beyond the hall, out of sight. He was startled as I came upon him, like I had walked in on him with his pants down. It was a breach, and he knew it. Scurrying to effect some semblance of normality, he pointed and smiled at a jumbo blow-up of Obama hanging on the wall, like he had just stopped briefly to admire Pete Souza's latest work. "You looking for somebody?" I asked suspiciously. With that, he continued on to upper press. I took a detour down to lower press, where I found Marie. "How long ago did Johnny pass through here?" I asked. "A while, why?" Johnny's actions forced a new policy. We instituted an unofficial yet crucial piece of protocol in upper press that Vels was in the unique position to execute. His seat aimed directly down the hallway, so he was the first to spot approaching reporters. To alert the rest of us, he took to yelling the names of incoming reporters, greeting them loudly enough that, if need be, our sensitive conversations were hushed, our bosses' doors were quickly shut, and our close hold, meaning not to be shared, desktop documents were minimized. Whenever anybody from Politico headed up, Vels lost all sense of shame. "Politico's in the house, everybody. Hide the secrets." He would yell good-naturedly, usually to self-deprecating appreciation from the reporter. Politico's assigned seat is toward the middle of the briefing room, near the Hill spot. Both of these outlets were founded to focus more on the day-to-day politics of Washington, mirroring the direction of cable news, than on policy. Sometimes more style than substance, the Hill newspaper and website was famous for its 50 Most Beautiful People edition, one of those important projects I was tasked with spearheading for the White House. Politico, The Hill, and others like them provided yet another perspective with which our press secretaries needed to contend. If on its better days the first row focused on substance, then there were these middle row reporters ready to pick up the slack and pose questions that were purely political. To be fair, these outlets have recently stepped up their investigative and policy reporting in important, impressive ways, evolving slowly away from who's up, who's down reporting. And beyond them, on the periphery of the room, without assigned seats, there were the hanger-outers, the usually lovable oddballs who took up residence in the briefing room for no ostensible reason other than to be around. There was a lovely older woman who had covered the White House for nearly 50 years. She liked to remind us that she was probably going to die soon, often visiting upper press before or after the press briefing with a box of chocolates for the press secretary, who was usually in briefing prep or briefing wrap-up. "I just want to thank him for calling on me," she would say, handing me the box to pass along. Before ambling back down the ramp to the briefing room and then up the driveway, she often asked, "You'll come to my funeral, won't you?" Some thought her family needed to step in. She wasn't doing well and was in no shape to schlep through security and into the White House, where she would rarely get into question. She struggled to walk, and her voice was softening. She was battling Parkinson's disease. Truth is, the White House was important to her, and being in the thick of things was probably the best thing for her spirits. We appreciated what she was doing and why she was there, but that didn't make her comments about her upcoming funeral any less uncomfortable. There were less sympathetic characters, too, elbowing their way to the margins of the 49-seat briefing room. Christine had a hair-trigger temper. She was prone to paranoia and wrote often of conspiracy theories and completely unfounded gossip about the staff. She once accused Vels of practicing voodoo against her. She was litigious, too. I've changed her name, obviously. Claiming discrimination, threatening to sue the White House and individual staffers, once for what she claimed was tainted tuna fish from the vending machine. Eventually, the Secret Service stepped in. We didn't see much more of Christine after that. There was Ricky, the friendly part-time Uber driver and part-time political observer, with a hard-to-find blog who occasionally fell asleep, snoring disruptively during the briefings. And then there was Goyle. Much has been made of the briefing room's resident Indian reporter without a paper for which to report. I knew him mostly as the friendly man who dropped by lower and upper press at least weekly with a plastic bag of inexplicably warm fruit and dented canned goods. It was a sweet gesture, even if the presentation left a bit to be desired. Sometimes the bag had to go right into the trash, more bait for Bo and Sunny to sift through. More often, somebody would grab the bag before walking home, ready to hand it off to the nearest homeless person. I like to take the bananas home for smoothies. Goyle made real waves throughout the West Wing when he brought a life-size, creepily lifelike bust of Mahatma Gandhi to my desk as a gift for the president. This was not something we could throw in the trash. It looked much too real, like it had been pulled from the costume department of a movie set. I called Brian, the director of operations, to come over. I wasn't going to be the one to walk this over to the Oval Office, but he was tied up, so he hid Mahatma behind the door to Katie Byrne Fallon's office. Katie, one of my many bosses, was at a meeting. She was the deputy communications director at the time, just before taking over as the director of legislative affairs, the White House's chief liaison to Capitol Hill. Emails began pouring back in, and we forgot about the little guy for a few hours, until Katie returned from her marathon of meetings. She closed the door behind her. Then we heard a shriek as she blasted through her office door in terror. Eventually, Gandhi made his way throughout the West Wing, left on bosses' desks by assistants looking for playful revenge, and in office corners to shock unsuspecting staffers. He even made it to the Resolute desk, where the president eyed him skeptically, a glare Pete Souza caught for posterity and turned into a jumbo that hung in the West Wing. Goyle was escorted to the basement of the West Wing to see the photo and appreciate the impression he had made. The bust wasn't the first time that Goyle had made his mark. It was said that press secretaries from previous administrations, when they needed to veer away from a problematic line of questions, would call on Goyle, who would, without fail, ask about the U.S.-India relationship, sidelining whatever the rest of the room wanted to discuss. It was a creative form of filibustering that our press secretaries sometimes indulged. You never knew what you were going to get from the folks on the outskirts. Goyle once asked Josh if the president was celebrating International Yoga Day. Josh, never one to sidestep a dad joke, leveled one of his best groaners. I think that question's a bit of a stretch. As soon as Josh entered upper press, trailed by his deputies and assistants, all still laughing off the dad jokeness of it all, I accused him of planning the question to get in his punchline. He denies it, and I'm inclined to believe him. That room will ask anything. A year earlier, as Jay Carney, Josh's predecessor, wrapped up his daily briefing, someone asked, "Jay, is there a red fox running loose on the White House grounds?" That was my fault. As I grew out of wrangling, I took on a kind of utility player role. I had started some writing, was taking on message and event planning responsibilities, and every once in a while, I was tasked with story management. That's what we called it when someone oversaw a specific issue or upcoming story. Bobby managed stories related to Homeland Security. Matt managed stories about education and other domestic issues. Amy was in charge of the economy. I got stories about White House varmints. The Wall Street Journal's Carol Lee, a White House regular, is an example of a reporter whose work sometimes caused us trouble, but who was a gifted reporter and a congenial person. We occasionally disliked her stories, but it never interfered with her working relationship with the White House staff. When I was a media monitor, I remember there was a hubbub over one of Carol's upcoming pieces. My bosses asked me to compile her latest 20 stories to help prepare for her pending article and to get a sense of just how bad it would be. Still, we knew it was a part of a reporter's job, and we did our best, though we often failed, not to take it personally. That's the way it was with many of the talented White House beat reporters, part of the natural, healthy tension. In early 2014, Carol had an idea for a less controversial piece. There was a fox that was said to be sleuthing about the White House in the evenings, darting between the shadows, startling staffers exiting late at night. Carol wanted to do a deep dive on the sneaky fox, and her editors were interested. Josh quickly looped me into the email. I was just the man for the job, he claimed. It was the first and most successful story I would ever deal with. Managing a story involved seeing it through, beginning with getting a sense from the reporter of the direction and tone of the piece. Did the story need shaping on our end, or was it best left alone? To shape a story is to engage with it. You can do that on a number of levels. White House officials can speak to the reporter on background, meaning that the content of what they're saying can be reported on, but not quoted. What's more, the source is not to be named, and instead referred to as an agreed-upon alias, such as a senior administration official or a source close to the matter. Then there are on-the-record interviews in which the content of the discussion, including quotes, is free game, and sources are to be identified by their real names. These become more complicated when the source is not accustomed to dealing with the press, or when the source is high level. While the Fox story didn't need much shaping, we decided to engage because lighthearted White House content, without infringing on the president's time, can be hard to come by. We ran with Carol's idea. We would provide on-the-record sit-downs for the Fox piece, but they would be straightforward, with folks like Dale, whose unofficial role of minding Bo and Sonny was eclipsed only by his official job as caretaker of the White House grounds. Carol had a sense that this story could be big. She asked for more sources and additional quotes. For a week, I went around asking everybody I came across if they had seen the Fox, and if so, whether they would be willing to go on the record about it. I even took it to Brian in the outer Oval Office. Do you mind asking the president if he's seen a fox running around his lawn? It was exactly the kind of question I would be tasked with asking the outer Oval. Pointless, but part of my job. I didn't get an immediate answer, but Carol told me that the story was getting juicier. It had front page potential, what with the wordplay possibilities and unorthodox nature of the thing. She told me that the Fox was going to get the special treatment, its own stipple portrait, the dot drawings for which the Wall Street Journal was famous. I pushed Brian to ask the boss and eventually got an answer. I can confirm for you that the president has seen the Fox, Carol. It was the talk of the town the morning the exposé ran. Despite the frivolous nature of the story, I was riding high, collecting accolades for a job well done. My first story, okay, it was Carol's story, was on the front page. Blogs picked up the piece throughout the day, and that evening, the pièce de résistance, the nightly news, the staple of American newscasts, was considering running with the Fox story. However, it turned out to be a busy news day. After all, the healthcare red team had been building to this day for months. They were working on Obamacare open enrollment, one of the president's top priorities. The healthcare exchanges had closed at the end of the prior month, and the numbers were just coming in. The news was good. Our goal had been to sign up 7 million Americans, but 8 million had signed up for quality, affordable health insurance, many for the first time. Good Obamacare news was even harder to come by than lighthearted White House fare. This was a major and somewhat unexpected win. A banner news day for the White House Communications Office. Unfortunately, there's not a ton of space on the evening news, and both pieces didn't fit. Which do you think made the cut? The Media Monitor sent out the nightly news clips. Congratulations started to pour in. Jesse, from the Red Team, wrote, "We just learned that 8 million Americans signed up for healthcare for the first time in history, but it got bumped from the news for the White House Fox. But congrats to Pat." It's easy to criticize the nightly news for bumping crucial Obamacare news, information that affects people's lives, for a silly story about a fox. But the truth is, very often, they're just giving the people what they want. That's not to say that there aren't some very broken things about the media, but their actions are driven largely by readers, viewers, consumers. People don't want to read about policy. They want to read about people. It's part of why politics is so peculiar, too. Why the personality of the candidate often trumps his or her ideas. We knew that, of course, which is why we went to great lengths to engage real people in the debate of the day and to reach people where they are, one of our mantras, whether that's on YouTube or a comedy show with Jerry Seinfeld. News media executives knew the same as we did, and that's where politics and media meet. But there is also an important disconnect between the way the media as a whole is set up and the way the government works. It's something President Obama often discussed. He would tell us, in good times and in bad, that the federal government is akin to an aircraft carrier at sea. It takes a long time to alter its course. Turning around is difficult. Change, for better or worse, he would say, takes time. Sure, history zigs and zags, but currents run deep, and ramifications, like ripples radiating from the engines of an aircraft carrier, can take a long time to hit. That's a notion fundamentally at odds with the way the political media report now, in an age when who's up and who's down is determined by the end of every day, and when Twitter's hot takes decide the same thing by the minute. Although cable news has nothing but time to fill, reporters, anchors, and network executives all act as if they are running out of it. They rush. POTUS, on the other hand, understood that winners and losers are determined over months, decades even, not minutes or days. That, to him, was a more appropriate, if impractical, measure of progress. It's a belief that sometimes set up a clash between the president and his press team. It was our job to pay attention to what the media were doing every minute, while President Obama took a much longer view of the horizon, of politics, the press, and history. It would serve him well, especially toward the end of his second term. News of the day rarely riled him up, or even particularly interested him. Somehow he was more engrossed in intellectual think pieces and deep dives on healthcare policy than Politico's latest accounting of who's up and who is down inside the Beltway. Sometimes I hoped he would snap a bit, maybe take a turn as Michael Douglas in The American President, talk about serious problems and serious people, and remind the world, my name's Barack Obama and I am the president. But he was usually too calm, totally collected. Even when his staff was spinning out around him, he was the quiet at the center of the storm. The president's untroubled, logical demeanor often drew comparisons to Star Trek's Mr. Spock. The big ears probably didn't hurt that comparison. But there were exceptions to the Spock-like practicality when it came to the press, and they were usually personal. In February 2013, the Washington Post Style section ran an article titled, Michelle Obama's Posterior Again the Subject of a Public Rant. The story recounted the latest moron to comment on the First Lady's appearance and then delved into the historical precedent for such chatter and included quotes such as, she looks great for her age. There was also some butt wordplay. This was an example of a story written in service of an eye-catching headline, clickbait. None of this sat well with the First Lady's husband. He erupted into upper press, mad as hell, ready to do a little ranting of his own. I hadn't seen him like this since I first started in the West Wing. At least I knew what to do this time. Look busy, get to typing. It's totally disrespectful, POTUS said of the piece to Jennifer Palmieri, who was then the White House Communications Director. J-Pom, as we called her, was a wonderful boss, confident and shrewd and sharp, capable of holding her own in the face of a frustrated president. She did her best to quell his temper. You can't undo the damage of a story with a correction. Nor would one be offered, but the White House was equipped to let reporters and their editor bosses know when we thought a story was off base, incorrect, or, in this case, completely out of line and offensive. Still, the president didn't take his annoyance public. There would be no Michael Douglas-like speech in the briefing room, no barrage of tweets. He vented privately, he got it off his chest, and he moved on. It was, however, good practice for J-Pom's next gig, running communications for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. It was precisely the kind of superficial coverage she would deal with every day. We messed up a lot. We yelled at reporters, we nitpicked their headlines, we sometimes took out our frustrations on them, even when their stories were completely legitimate. And sometimes they were unfair to us, or they broke embargoes, or maybe they lingered a little too long outside our hall, listening in on private conversations. But in a broader sense, for 8 years, both sides, the president and the press, kept up the American covenant that says our press is free and that the people's house is theirs too. As Josh says, the briefing is about accountability and preserving trust between the White House and the American people. That trust is fragile. We've seen how it can be eroded, how the most powerful person on earth can use his platform to sow doubt, impugn motives, and make us all a little less free. Sure, we preserve the natural tension between the president and the press. But we preserve the trust, too, and an idea of objective truth as a foundation for debate. Josh liked to say that the briefing is a venue to make an argument, but that argument is fruitless without a set of facts from which to work. Jay, a former journalist at Time, knew better than most what it was like on both sides of the White House podium, and everybody who sat in upper and lower press knew that we weren't the only public servants who came to work every day at the White House. That's why I was proud of the way Josh and Jay handled their responsibilities as press secretary. They prepared for news of the day questions, sure, but they also tried to be ready for whatever was on the minds of the dozens of individuals, of varying degrees of aptitude and relevance, spread throughout the briefing room's assigned seats and along its periphery. And I was always proud of the way they handled the standing room only reporters. Who were we to say who should or shouldn't come to the people's house and question us? They were treated with respect, no matter how ludicrous we found their questions. The White House Correspondents Association pushed us for more access. We pushed back. It's a conflict that will continue. The president's press team will always look out for the chief executive and his agenda first. And the press pool wouldn't be doing its job if it wasn't advocating constantly for additional access to the president and his team. We embraced our roles fully, but both sides always knew that the other wasn't the antagonist. Still, the members of the press weren't our partners either, which is why I suppose it wouldn't have been appropriate for Chuck Todd to march through the EEOB on Taco Tuesday at Ike's. It was important to preserve the natural boundaries, a buffer, that exists among the president, his staff, and the press. But we knew something that we thought obvious, something we thought never needed to be said, but maybe it does. The press is not the enemy of the American people. As the vice president's mom would say, they're no better than us, and we're no better than them. Common DC stories, so you know what to look out for. Think piece. Often bloated, these deep dives are meant to rise above news of the day, but frequently fall into the same daily tropes of Washington. Bad ones are overwrought, asking questions without offering meaningful answers. Good ones make you think about an issue or person in a different way. The obituary can refer to a policy proposal or a person. The press loves to declare the end, death, whether by sinking polls or looming scandal. The comeback, a natural companion to the obituary. The press is quick to equate a bounce in the polls or a well-done mea culpa to a full-blown comeback, a masterstroke of political brilliance, back from the brink. Counter-narrative. The media thrive on plot twists, and if no pivot is on the way, they sometimes manufacture one with a story positing that the opposite of what's happening is really happening. The Oppo Dump. Slightly repurposed from the research departments at the White House or any number of congressional offices, these are glorified press releases that friendly outlets, progressive and conservative alike, push out in the form of an independent article to further the intended narrative. The Profile. From presidential candidates in the Times to White House junior staffers in their hometown papers, these are typically fluff pieces, but profiles can go sideways if not managed properly. The Hot Take. Quick analyses, typically in terms of political winners and losers. They are basically tweets that become stories. The Flyover Drop-In. Occasionally, coastal reporters will go on location to the middle of the country, real America, to highlight a few people who embody the way Washington perceives America is feeling. Though these can be patronizing and overly general, the White House uses real people too. Stat stories. Some reporters love stats and write entire stories based on the number of times the president has played golf or traveled on Air Force One, for instance, banking on other outlets to pick up the figures and run with them, often to their own conclusions. Faulty autopsies. Win or lose, debates, policy fights, elections, the media scramble to explain the results, sometimes in an oversimplified and under-researched way. Palace intrigue pieces. Gossipy look-ins on the people behind the place, usually written when things aren't going well for the subjects of the article. Chapter 4, 2012. I know, 'cause I won both of them. Barack Obama. I was never farther from the inner workings of Washington than the day in 2009 that Barack Obama was first sworn in. I was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Stephanie, her twin sister Victoria, and I were on our way to Cadiz, Spain. It was the first leg of a 13-country itinerary through a study abroad program called Semester at Sea. To some, the program is a joke, a forced, curated adventure servicing some sense of culture. And I suffered no shortage of Semester at Sea jokes from my White House colleagues. Matt and Bobby particularly like to mention my cruise. Of course, their take is partially true, but it's far from the whole story, at least for my trip, thanks to my future boss. As with the previous 23 voyages, we on the MV Explorer departed the United States under the presidency of George W. Bush. Yet unlike the previous 8 years' worth of semesters, we arrived in our first port of call as Americans with a new leader, President Barack Obama. As it turned out, it would make all the difference in the world. On the second day of our voyage, January 20th, the captain came over the loudspeaker. Would everyone please power down their laptops? It was the only way we could hope to have enough bandwidth to live stream the inauguration. We were hundreds of miles off the eastern seaboard, where history was unfolding and the world that we were about to explore was watching. We didn't want to miss it. This was one of those public occasions, only a handful in a lifetime, good and bad, that you don't forget. A true where-were-you-then type of deal. Stephanie and I shuffled into a shipboard classroom, brimming and buzzing with students and faculty. We spotted an opening on the ground and took a seat. The buzz grew. Anticipation turned to excitement as a large projector screen at the front of the room sputtered to life. We caught glimpses of the pomp and pageantry. Armored limousines waiting in front of the north portico of the White House. Pennsylvania Avenue lined dozens of people deep. The National Mall was so jam-packed that only a high-flying helicopter could give it appropriate scope. We watched the first families exchange pleasantries. The television reporters walked us through the protocol as the incoming and outgoing presidents began the time-honored and uniquely American tradition of peacefully transitioning the awesome power of the presidency from one person to the next, and in this case, from one party to another. We burst into applause as President-elect Obama stepped through the narrow door framed by the north portico of the White House, a portal, the point of no return. He was on the way to become the 44th president of the United States. When he returned in just a few hours to the White House, it would be his home. On the MV Explorer, we hoped that our bandwidth would hold out as the seemingly endless motorcade made its way down Pennsylvania Avenue. On-air personalities told of the backstage commotion and machinations, the palace intrigue, the grand foyer and the East Room, and something called the Blue Room. They focused on the logistics of turning over the world's most famous home office in just a couple of hours. I couldn't picture it. In my mind, I had the mid-season, fine-tuned frenzy of Aaron Sorkin's The West Wing. The real West Wing was foreign to me. But at this very moment, as removed from the goings-on of Washington as I ever would be, my soon-to-be friends, co-workers, and bosses were filling up what I could only imagine was Sorkin's empty set, streaming into the White House for the first time. A group of young people who bought into that hopey, changey stuff. They traded in their campaign casual wear for suits, their personal phones for heavily encrypted federal government BlackBerries. They were starting their own voyage. They had arrived. And now, it was their job to turn promises into policy, as, for the first time, millennials moved into the West Wing. Meanwhile, their boss was making it official in front of the Capitol. On the ship, we held our breath. The feed cut out, which offered an opportunity to look around the room. Many students were already crying. Some were barely paying attention. Others sneered that their candidate had lost. Yet, most were overjoyed. The professors had a different look altogether. They were particularly compelled by the proceedings. "Everything's about to change," one of them said during the frozen frame. The feed popped back to life, eliciting relieved applause, which quickly gave way to raucous celebration when President Obama took his hand off the Bible, thanking Chief Justice John Roberts and stepping to the podium as our new president. I didn't know him. Stephanie didn't know him. But we felt like we did. That was part of the magic of the 2008 campaign, the candidate's ability to connect, to strike a nerve, a positive nerve. We felt like we knew what he meant for our country, like the reverse on several levels of the legendary Franklin Delano Roosevelt story. As historians retell it, at the time of FDR's funeral procession in April 1945, as the cortege carrying the president's coffin passed the crowds, one man broke down sobbing. A reporter nearby questioned the man. "Why are you crying so hard? Did you know him?" "No," the man replied. "But he knew me." This simple comment captured President Roosevelt's extraordinary ability to understand the struggles of others. For us, it was the same, only in reverse. Not grief, but hope as far as the horizon stretched. In a real sense that this man knew me, knew us, and our hopes, our hurts, and our aspirations. As Barack Obama took to the podium, the footage on our projection screen freezing and the audio faltering, our ship rocking and swaying, I swelled with pride. Stephanie did too. In his red tie and dark overcoat, he addressed America and provided context for the beginnings of his time in power. 44 Americans have now taken the presidential oath. The words have been spoken during the rising tides of prosperity and the still waters of peace. I glanced out the window. Our waters were far from peaceful. Yet every so often, the oath is taken amidst gathering clouds and raging storms. He recounted our current crisis, two wars in the Middle East, an economy in freefall, and a planet in peril. But he reminded us how and why we would get through. At these moments, America has carried on not simply because of the skill or vision of those in high office, but because we, the people, have remained faithful to the ideals of our forebears and true to our founding documents. So it has been. So it must be with this generation of Americans. As he concluded his inauguration, some of us took to the ship's stern. Rather than look down at the chop where the water swirled and clapped harshly against the MV Explorer, we focused on the horizon, motionless and peaceful. Hope as far as the eye could see. Stephanie and I couldn't imagine a cooler spot to watch an inauguration than from the Atlantic Ocean. Looking toward our first port of call, somebody shouted, "So I guess we don't have to pretend to be Canadian anymore, eh?" By the end of 2011, I was finally feeling at home in the West Wing. Like maybe I wasn't such an imposter after all. I understood the cadence of the morning hustle and could predict the din of the press briefing room as we announced, "2-minute warning, this is your 2-minute warning for the press briefing." I caught on that 2 minutes usually meant 5 or 6. I looked forward to the early afternoon lull, memorized when the mess line died down, and learned to always keep an eye tuned to the news. Underneath everything, I knew that any day could shift in an instant. And we began to feel like a family, for better or worse. Bobby, Schultz, Matt and Hallie, Marie and Antoinette, Josh J., Brian and Dan, we were spending more time together than with our actual families. Rather than you or the White House, I started to say we and us. But just as I was learning the ways of the West Wing, America was lurching toward its next presidential election. Before I knew it, the time had come to ramp up for re-election, to prove to the American people why any of us belonged. President Obama often joked that he and his family were just renting, and that their lease would soon be up. He sensed the impermanence of it all, even as some of us, especially many of the millennials, couldn't grapple with the thought that maybe there would come a time when we weren't working for this president in this building. It was all my adult self knew. I didn't want to grow up and enter the real world. At the very least, we had to put it off for another 4 years. Looking back on the 2012 presidential campaign can be a blur. Everybody knows the top line. Mitt Romney, a seemingly out-of-touch Mormon millionaire, lost badly to President Obama in an election that centered on the economy. If you had asked me on that ship in 2009 about the 2008 election, I probably would have given a similarly concise, overly boiled-down wrap-up of the contest between Senators John McCain and Barack Obama. That's because I didn't have any idea of the long nights, the 7-day weeks, the many months that go into building those top lines that everyone remembers. And I had not yet felt the sting of the lowlights that everyone else forgets. $1 billion, a bunch of babies kissed, repeated punchlines and perpetual rope lines, worn slogans and endorsed messages, from West Hollywood to West Des Moines, and the Holiday Inn to the Four Seasons, across 4 very different seasons. 2012 taught me what it actually takes to get a person elected president of the United States. It started with a song. "The more you see, the less you know." I would rush from the motorcade, through the backstage pipe and drape, and toward the event site. The press pool would be right on my tail. We inserted ourselves into the buffer, crouched between the anxious crowd, weary from waiting, and the empty stage. The photographers readied their cameras and opened their laptops, spreading them across the floor. The camera person hoisted his hulking television camera up and over his shoulder. That was the routine. It's how every event kicked off. The introducer, chosen by the campaign to make a brief statement before the president hit the stage, would end his or her brief remarks with the same phrase. "And now, it's my honor to introduce the President of the United States, Barack Obama." A good introducer knew to hold a beat after "and now," allowing the crowd to pull in its collective breath. Murmurs would shoot through the audience like lightning as, for just a second, the introducer was in control. But as soon as he or she said "honor," the room would leap to its feet, letting out a raucous cheer on "introduce." By "Barack," the cheer would have overflowed into a deafening shriek. Only the most rhetorically gifted introducers could keep their attention long enough to even make it to Obama before the floodgates opened and the crowd had taken control of the room. All eyes would be on the corner where the pipe and drape meets the bleachers. For a moment there would be nothing, a pregnant pause, the expectation boiling over. President Obama knew how to make an entrance. Then it would begin. The pluck of the electric guitar, then the crunch of another one, building to something more. The mounting rumble of the drums. Those seated in the stands by the pipe and drape would see him first, another cheer. The photographers would click away. To most of the crowd, he was still obscured, down on the floor level, shaking hands and waving. The expansive melody would take hold on the piano, escalating as you reach the bottom of the stairs. The more you see, the less you know. U2's City of Blinding Lights served as the entrance theme for just about all of the president's campaign events, including his announcement in 2007 that he was first running for president, which took place at the foot of the old state capitol in Springfield, Illinois, where he served as a state senator, where Abraham Lincoln got his start in politics. Rising, the song reached its crescendo in sync with the moment the president would crest the four stairs on the side of the stage. That's when he became visible to everyone in the arena, and the cheers overtook even you too. He would hug the introducer and put his arms in the air. For those of us who watched this spectacle unfold often two or three times a day, the cheers became part of the song, the shrieks a fitting piece of the orchestra, his waving and pointing an instrument to accompany the drums and guitar. All of this in service of the moment and the song, everybody, for a time, blinded by the lights. And then he'd take to the podium and hush the crowd. The quiet would be pierced by the inevitable, "We love you, Barack," and his automatic, "I love you back." Some laughter. Then he'd dig in, thanking his introducer, welcoming the crowd, pandering to the school's football team, or jabbing at the city's basketball team. "If you have a seat, sit down," he'd say, "and if not, bend your knees, I'm going to talk for a bit." And then he'd dive in, and I'd sit back in the buffer, my head against the bicycle rack that kept the crowd at bay. I listened to hundreds of these speeches, his rhythm rising, falling, repeating, culminating in an optimistic close or an earnest, "Now I'm letting you in on the real answer" moment, had become like second nature to me. It seeped beyond work. I remember Stephanie editing a letter I wrote to our landlord. "He didn't need to read about hope or change," she said. "He needed to fix our air conditioning." Still, the speeches were always tweaked before delivery, so Marie and I would send each other the last three paragraphs of the remarks, so we knew what phrase to look out for and when to prepare the pool to move from the buffer. During the campaign, Marie and I were on the road together constantly. We switched off. One of us minded the press pool and traveled on Air Force One. The other attended to the larger traveling press corps that followed Obama in a chartered plane and sat off to the side of the stage as the president delivered his remarks. President Obama would inevitably turn his attention to his opponent. This would elicit boos and the opportunity for him to deploy one of his favorite call and responses. "Don't boo," he would cry out, waiting for the crowd to reply with him, "Vote." From the buffer, I knew he was feeling good about the event if he slapped the side of the podium. It was his tell. By the time the first phrase and the last three paragraphs came about, he was usually on fire. He wasn't giving a speech anymore. He was delivering a sermon. Each word flowed into the next. Each turn of phrase upped the ante until finally, his voice becoming hoarse and the crowd overtaking him, he would shout, "Thank you, God bless you, and God bless the United States of America." He'd wave, and with a slap to the side of the podium, he'd be on his way to the buffer to shake some hands. As soon as Obama hit the steps, the music would return. The familiar driving beat of the drums and then the ensemble strains of the E Street Band took hold as I led the pool up to the stage, grabbed the president's remarks binder from his podium, and, for a flash, looked out from his previous vantage point, feeling for a fleeting moment the power of the president's platform. "We take care of our own. Wherever this flag's flown, we take care of our own." Bruce Springsteen's roaring chorus blared throughout the arena as a few lucky audience members joined the scrum by the buffer. They held out their babies for a lift and pawned off their books for a signature. It was hard to hear over the boss's anthem, Americana at its finest. But I wrestled the pool with hand gestures and nods. As the chorus wound down for the final time, I'd pull the pool back beyond the drapes, through the bowels of the building, and out to the motorcade, from where we'd come, on to the next stop, wherever our flag's flown. We did those events hundreds of times in service of one goal, re-electing President Obama. To do that, everybody, from the president to the press wranglers, needed to execute his and her jobs. For the president, his surrogates, and his senior campaign advisors, the job was clear. Promote our policies while painting Mitt Romney as out of touch with the middle class. Funny thing is, the Romney team had the exact same plan, to portray an aloof Obama who was hindering rather than helping the middle class. To us, Romney was a rich robot. Not a bad guy, but not the right guy for Americans who don't own car elevators. To them, Obama was a big government elitist who didn't understand the struggles of middle-class Americans or the burdens government imposes on them. To us, Obama had staved off the Second Great Depression, saved the auto industry, and fundamentally rebuilt healthcare in a way that benefited tens of millions of Americans. To them, Obama was a failed president. Those were the theses, and they were clear. Each campaign had a theory of the case about the opposing candidate. The months leading up to the election were about making the argument, over and over, until we could take a completed thesis to the Electoral College in November. In the meantime, we took our case to the American people. Even by 2012, with the Obama campaign building on its success in 2008, social media would never be enough, and so the Fourth Estate was never out of sight or mind. As we kicked into campaign mode, Josh took Antoinette and Marie and me aside and impressed upon each of us how crucial our role was. We were on the front lines, the Obama staffers most in touch with the press. He told us that it could be easy to forget, to think of ourselves as simply press wranglers or assistants, but that on the road, we represented the president. Small, seemingly meaningless miscues could spiral, sending things into a tailspin. "Let's not give anybody any reason to doubt our competency," he said. To me, that meant getting the little things right. It's been said that campaigns are like startups on steroids, so there are a lot of little things to bear in mind. Thousands of people, staffers, volunteers, vendors, thrust together with a singular intention. The 2012 startup was again based out of Chicago. There are strict rules bifurcating campaign staffers and White House officials, but a few people fell somewhere in between. A handful of senior aides, such as Dan, Jay, Valerie, Jarrett, and others, were legally allowed to take part in the campaign in their official capacity as White House staffers. Fewer low-level staffers were allowed to travel with the president on the campaign. Marie and I were among the lucky few, fortunate to have been designated wranglers at the right time. Our Secret Service hardpins, as they were called, provided universal and unfettered access to the presidential bubble. We had free rein of the place, sans standard security checks. Our quarter-sized red or blue pins seemed a rather low-tech instrument for such a powerful measure of access. But off we went, clapping our pins to our shirts, two cogs in the massive roadshow machine that was the 2012 election. By the time the campaign got into full swing, a dedicated press charter plane was put into effect, hauling dozens of reporters, producers, and crew wherever Obama went. Marie and I took turns. One of us would go on Air Force One with the smaller press pool, and one of us would go on the charter, which was the cushier gig. When with the pool in Air Force One, we needed to be on guard constantly, ready to relay information, parry questions, mind the reporters, or make changes on the fly. On the charter, there was less to do. The White House travel office ran the show. My biggest worry on those flights was the handsy middle-aged stewardesses who were a tad too attentive. On the charter, there was a clear caste system. On-air talent, big-time print reporters, and experienced producers sat at the front, in first class. Cameramen, crew, as well as more junior reporters, or folks from lesser-known outlets, sat toward the back. Up front, conversations among those in first class often turned to which reporter would be named in the lead of the article, should the plane crash. The plane never went down. It typically arrived at the event site hours prior to the president in the pool. For outdoor sites, we'd hurry into great white tents, where the press filed their stories and where the buffet stood ready to fill up ravenous reporters and staffers. Reggie Love, the president's first body man, which is a DC term for the always-present person at the side of his or her boss, ready with everything from a tic-tac to classified documents, offered wise counsel about life on the road. "Eat on the plane or at the event," he told me, "not both." I failed to heed his advice and ate my way through more states than I care to remember. Really, it was the same 9 swing states over and over again. Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Ohio, Virginia, and Wisconsin. Plus, dashes to California for fundraising. Sometimes we took the road less traveled. In Iowa, we embarked on a 3-day bus tour across the state. Iowa held a special place in the hearts of Obama people. The prairie-filled state had propelled him toward the presidency 4 years prior. And those who were there, including Obama, talk about that night like folklore. Politics at its best, they like to say. We were back 4 years later to try and recapture that magic. The president's hulking, armored black bus, complete with a presidential seal next to its impenetrable door, rumbled down narrow roads, bisecting dry cornfields and cresting rolling hills. Only at the top of those hills did it become truly clear. We were a behemoth of an organization, swooping down into Middle America, out of place and very much in the way. The giant vehicle, Bus Force One, or Ground Force One, as it was known, was reduced to the size of a toy matchbox car from my view in a vehicle toward the back of the motorcade. The president was trailed and preceded by countless police cars and motorcycles, nearly a dozen black Suburbans and numerous buses, one filled with Secret Service agents prepared to leap into action in an instant, and another stuffed with journalists ready to report. Our rolling presidential convoy kicked up a great deal of dust and dirt, drew its fair share of onlookers, and delayed locals just trying to go on about their lives. But that's what we were after, the locals. We wanted interactions, meetings with Middle America. Rolling through town in a tank-like bus wasn't the most relatable method of making connections, however. So we pandered to what unites so many Americans. Four more beers. As we crisscrossed Iowa, the chant rang out repeatedly. The public had recently learned that the White House was brewing its own beer, a honey ale and a honey porter. And the president was not above divvying out our stock, stored on Bus Force One, to local Iowans. Crowds particularly loved it when Obama was willing to have a drink at the bar with patrons. It was easy positive publicity for totally normal behavior. Polls in Iowa mirrored the national ones, a tight race. But Obama held the edge. We felt good. And the beer didn't hurt. Even as the world obsessed over the election, I was fixated on something even more important. By 2012, Stephanie and I had been grade school, high school, and thanks to the wise counsel of Dr. Phil and Larry King, college sweethearts. In all, we had been together for 12 years, half our lives. People were starting to ask about our plans, which was code for, it's time to step up, dude. Marie and Antoinette were no different. They had been needling me for a couple of weeks to no avail about if and when I was going to pop the question. The first part was easy. Yes, of course I was going to ask Stephanie to marry me. The second part, the specifics of it all, was a bit blurrier. Things came into focus the night of the state dinner in honor of David Cameron in the United Kingdom. Technically, because state dinners are reserved for heads of state, the Queen, rather than simply heads of government, the Prime Minister, this was actually an official dinner. But it was grander than any state dinner the Obama White House had ever thrown. The White House set up a colossal white tent on the South Lawn, hidden beneath limbs of massive trees and concealed from the outside by bushes and the South Lawn fence. It was rather like an elegant backyard wedding, if your backyard wedding was filled with celebrities and CEOs, dignitaries and diplomats. There was an old-timey trolley shuttling guests from the entrance reception by the East Wing to the main event a few hundred yards away. Everybody was dressed to the nines. Even we Wranglers needed to dress up. I wore a dark suit that I pretended was a tux, while Marie and Antoinette wore floor-length gowns which concealed their sneakers. High heels are not efficient wrangling footwear. We ushered the press pool into the tent at the appropriate time, to hear toasts from President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron, as well as the first song or two from the night's entertainment, and Marie's favorite band, London's Mumford & Sons. I had never heard of them, and therefore offered to depart with the first wave. I met up with Marie and Antoinette by the mess, but not the mess pickup window like usual. Because we were staffing the dinner, we were allowed to crash the fancier side of the White House Navy mess, the exclusive wood-paneled room just behind the pickup window. Antoinette, who was nothing short of direct, asked what the latest was. When are you going to pop the question? Maybe it was the formal wear and the dancing, the toasts and the swanky tables. It could have been David Cameron's charm, or singer John Legend's very public displays of affection for his date, model Chrissy Teigen, just beyond the view of the press pool. Whatever it was, I was in the mood for a wedding of my own, and I decided to quit obfuscating in front of my friends. I was going to do it, I told them, which elicited quick, frenzied feedback. How? When? Where? I want to do it here. I discussed with my parents, as well as Stephanie's sister Victoria, where to do it, and landed on the White House. It was such a big part of my life, an increasingly important place to Stephanie, who was becoming more interested in politics and impressed by the president than even I was. Initially, I worried that the Rose Garden was cliché, but my parents told me to snap out of it, that I was nuts to even say such a thing. The Rose Garden, it would be. It's not that the rest of the White House community wasn't as supportive as Marie and Antoinette. Instead, some of my bosses and colleagues, as well as a reporter or two, simply had a different perspective, and they weren't afraid to share it. As the agreed-upon proposal date got closer, and the planning among Antoinette, Marie, and me picked up steam, Schultz would ask, "Don't you need a letter from your parents or something?" Matt and Bobby wondered whether interns were allowed to get engaged at the White House. Another boss called me a child bride. We had to keep the plans hidden entirely from Brian, who would not have taken kindly to somebody putting the White House grounds, especially the Rose Garden, to use for personal, non-presidential pursuits.